Tax Update for June 2nd, 2007. This is Tax Update for Saturday, June 2nd, 2007. Tax Update podcast is intended for tax professionals and is not designed for those not skilled in independent tax research. All readers and listeners are expected to do their own research to confirm matters raised in this presentation before relying upon the positions presented. The podcast supporting document may be reproduced freely so long as no fee is charged for the use of the document or the audio file. Such a prohibited use include using this podcast or document as part of a CP presentation for which a fee is charged. The podcast is sponsored by Limebrook Information Services, located on the web at www.limebrookservices.com. Limebrook Information Services offers email newsletters on tax-related matters, as well as access to a library of useful information to tax practitioners as described to their services. Again, you can visit them on the web at www.limebrookservices.com. This week, we look at the updated penalty, preparer penalty provisions in the new tax law and how they apply to our practice. Now, before we get started, though, I want to first go over a little more continuing errata about last week's discussion, and specifically the update where we dealt with the kiddie tax, and now perhaps a little more guidance on how the kiddie tax will work under the new bill. Studying it in a little more detail, we discover that it's a little bit more nuanced than you might have first thought. In fact, it appears the new kiddie tax breaks into three separate categories. Now we have one group, which is those individuals under age 18, children in that category. Their excess income is automatically subject to the kiddie tax regardless of any other income or type of things they have. Still have the exception for married, but we'll ignore that for a while. If the child is exactly age 18 at the end of the year, then a single factor test is applied. And that test says that if the child has earned income that is less than one half of the child's support level for the year, then the child's excess investment income has to be taxed at the parent's rates. In essence, the kiddie tax applies. Now, when the child turns 19 through age 23, that one half of earned income test still applies, but in addition to meeting that test for the kiddie tax to apply, the child must also be a full-time student. Why does it work this way? Well, it works this way because of how Congress decided to reference things in the new provision. Section 1G now, which applies to kiddie tax, says essentially it applies to all individuals who have not attained age 18, and for those who have attained age 18, then we look at Section 152E3 Cap A for the post-18 test, plus we look at the question as to whether the individual had over one half of their income, one half of their support, covered by their earned income for the year. If you take a look at 152C3 Cap A, though, you're going to discover that it does have two different tests. It has one test for those who have not attained age 19, and that particular test says essentially they're in the group and can be counted as a dependent, subject to the other standard rules we have in that regard. And then from 19, those who have attained age 19 at least, but who are not yet attained age 24, then there is a special rule for being a full-time student. So because of that, we essentially break the kiddie tax now down into three groups. And Congress has provided apparently an incentive for those ages 19 to 23 who have significant unearned income to drop out of school and go ahead and get that Porsche. In any event, it is a little more nuanced than we thought, and there are some special situations that may arise where you need to consider this particular issue. Plus, there's been a number of discussions in the online discussion groups that I visit from time to time regarding this whole issue of now the crazy support test and finding out if the earned income is greater than the child's computed support. Different set of issues, different problems. Now, this week's main topic that we're going to look at going forward is another topic that generated a lot of controversy and discussion this week on various forums and groups, and that is a matter that we glanced over rather quickly last week but want to look at in more detail this week. And this is the changes to the preparer penalties under Section 6694. Now, I've gotten into it a little more detail this week because I'm preparing up and doing some modifications to the materials for a presentation I'm going to make here in Phoenix on July 27th for the Arizona Society of CPAs, a full-day CPE presentation, where we're going to talk about tax practice and tax practice standards, Well, in this particular case, one of the issues we're going to look at are preparer penalties. And Section 6694 was on the agenda. 6694 has now become a more important part of the agenda due to some recent changes that were made in the new law. These new standards apply to essentially any return you are now preparing and filing. That includes returns from last year that are on extension. Any return that is basically submitted after the effective date of the law, which was May 25th, is covered by these new rules, and therefore a preparer can be sanctioned for violation of these rules for those returns. So the returns you are now doing or now processing will be covered by these rules. But before we worry about the change, let's go back and review how the law used to be. And let's look at Section 6694 prior to the change. Now, if you download the materials from my website that are linked over from the either the Limeburg site where you find this particular episode archived, or over on my site where I have it on the Libsyn site that has this archived, you'll find a link to the materials for this particular session. And these materials on page 2 have Section 6694A as it existed prior to the law change. Prior to the law change, there was a penalty imposed on understatements due to an unrealistic position. And that said, if any part of any understatement of liability with respect to an item or claim for refund is due to a position for which there is not a realistic possibility of being sustained on the merits, then that was the case where an income tax preparer could be subjected to a penalty unless there was disclosure on the form that it was basically, it needed to be disclosed as provided for in Section 6662D2BII. Now, that deals with the individual taxpayer's penalty for substantial understatement. And the position was not frivolous, then you shall pay a penalty of $250. So that was the old standard. Under the old standard, therefore, we need to be concerned about what was a realistic possibility of being sustained on the merits and what exactly was a, shall we say, not a frivolous position. Well, the definition of what constitutes a realistic possibility was found in Regulation 1.6694-2B1. And that provided, essentially, if we look in the regulations there, that a position had a realistic possibility of being sustained on its merits if a reasonable and well-informed analysis by a person knowledgeable in the tax law would lead to the conclusion that the position had at least a 1 out of 3 chance of being sustained on its merits. Now, key issue. It points out, and this is an item that recurs multiple times, Circular 230 recurs in multiple places within these provisions and discussions. In making this 1 in 3 determination, you cannot consider the possibility of any audit lottery provision. That is, specifically, you can't consider that the return will not be audited or that an agent would not raise the issue on audit, maybe perhaps because the agent just isn't going to notice or won't have enough understanding to raise the issue. You cannot even in reality consider that, well, that's a fine position, but we all know that when it gets to appeals, they'll compromise the position. So we'll get this position as a compromise result in appeals. You know, they'll give it up there. We have to presume the case and the facts go before a judge with competent counsel representing both sides, and the determination is made based on the situation, determination is made about the propriety of the treatment in question. And that's where we provide the 1 out of 3 check. Now, under the old rules, you know, basically we're looking at 1 out of 3. And that was true as well under the issues that we're kind of look at, as we'll discuss later when we're going to discuss the Circular 230 requirements as well. Now, the regulations provide a number of examples of how we apply the realistic possibility standards. Those are found at Regulations 1.6694-2B3. And I've reproduced those particular examples in the materials in this particular guide, not because they're necessarily going to be totally valid as we go forward. You're going to discover the realistic possibility standard kind of becomes irrelevant, at least for the 6694A penalty, but because it gives you some ideas about how things should be applied and how we apply the analysis of what is adequate support. For instance, in the first example, they talk about a statute that's unclear as to whether a certain transaction has engaged and will result in a favorable tax position. Prior law supported the position. There are no regulations under the new statute and no authority other than the language in the committee reports. The committee reports state the intent was not to adversely affect transactions similar to the taxpayers. In that case, they said we met the realistic possibility standard. Now, what's probably more important, for example, too, is where they tell us that in a similar case where the taxpayers engaged in transactions, prior law supported a position favorable. The current statute basically does not support the taxpayer's position at all or is totally adversely affected. The preparer believes the statute is inequitable as applied to the situation, but the language is unambiguous that it does apply. In that case, it becomes clear, and the committee reports do not address the taxpayer's situation, a position contrary to statute does not satisfy the realistic possibility standard. And if it doesn't satisfy that standard, it's not going to satisfy higher standards, and that will become important. Now, in example three, they go on with the same example, except the intent did not indicate that we didn't intend for this to apply to the taxpayer's transaction. There's a conflict between the general language, which adversely affects the transaction, and a statement in the committee reports to say it will not be affected. It notes that a position consistent with either the statute or the committee reports satisfies the realistic possibility standard. However, a position consistent with the committee reports constitutes a disregard of a rule or a regulation, and therefore must be adequately disclosed to avoid the section 6694B, which is a more significant penalty. So an interesting conclusion there is that we could be hit for the B penalty, which is the bigger one, not the A penalty, even though we now have a realistic possibility standard satisfied. Now, we have a couple of other examples that go on through and raise other particular issues regarding realistic possibility. Again, I suggest you review through those and take a look at that to get some idea and get your ground rules. Remember, whenever we don't satisfy realistic possibility, we're not going to satisfy the higher standards, and we're now going to be looking at a higher standards. Now, as well, we go on that for purposes of coming to conclusion on realistic possibility, we look to the sources found in regulation section 1.662-423III. And that regulation tells us what are appropriate sources that may provide substantial authority, which is kind of a different set of rules and something that applies to the individual taxpayer in some cases, and we'll talk about that provision. But we still go back to these sources for evaluation of authority. And you have to consider the natures of the authority and the types. And the types of authority, which are found at 3III in this particular section, are enumerated in some details. And that tells us that, in fact, here are some of the key authorities that constitute substantial authorities. The Internal Revenue Code, the statutory provision, proposed temporary and final regulations construing such statutes, revenue rulings and revenue procedures, tax treaties and regulations thereunder, and Treasury Department and other official explanations of the treaties, court cases, congressional intent as reflected in committee reports, joint explanatory statements of the manager including the conference committee reports, and floor statements made prior to enactment by one of the bill's managers, general explanation of tax legislation prepared by the Joint Committee on Taxation, the Blue Book for a particular law, private letter rulings and technical advice memorandum issued after October 31, 1976, actions on decisions and general counsel memoranda issued after March 12, 1981, as well as general counsel memorandums published in a pre-1955 volumes of the Cumulative Bulletin, Internal Revenue Service information or press releases and notices, announcements, and other administrative pronouncements published by the Service Internal Revenue Bulletin, conclusions released in treatises, legal periodicals, legal opinions, or opinions rendered by tax professionals are not authority. However, the authority underlying such expression of opinion where applicable to the facts of a particular case may give rise to substantial authority for tax treatment of an item. Now, this is important because you have to understand that you can't just say CCH says this. You can't just say that, you know, RIA says this, Kleinrock says it, the Quick Finders book says this. That's not substantial authority. The underlying sources for those authorities, though, for those statements may be important. That is why it is extremely important from a research perspective that the sources you're relying upon, you're using for your research to determine positions, need to refer and footnote their way back to the primary sources. In order to rely on a document, you need to know how the author of that document came to the conclusion, which means they should be footnoting their way back. Some documents are better than others at footnoting. Some guidance and some articles you read are much better than others at doing it. That's true of even things like continuing education manuals. Again, you need the citation, but remember, the analysis is going to be evaluated based upon its use of substantial authority documentation, so you have to have substantial authority documentation to back you up. Otherwise, it doesn't work. Now, this is kind of an interesting discussion then about the sort of items that we should deal with. And we have the discussion for various items about reasonable basis and the like under section 6662. We continue on and discuss that. Then one of the key things to look at here, we're going to talk about, because this will come up later when we talk about how these things go together, is the reasonable basis definition under 6662.3b3. And reasonable basis is, we're told, is a relatively high standard of reporting that's significantly higher than not frivolous and not patently improper. Okay, well, remember, frivolous came up over under the preparer penalty, so we know this is a higher level. This is a taxpayer penalty definition, so it is somewhat important though to realize here. Again, frivolous, as you might expect, never manages to get protection. It says the reasonable basis standard is not satisfied by a return provision that is merely arguable or that is merely a colorable claim. So that is what we're going to talk about, is what is the reasonable basis standard. It says if it's based on the authority, well reasoned, it's fine. Now notice, this gives us a kind of hierarchy of authorities. And what we discover here is that we have reasonable basis. We also have substantial authority. Substantial authority, also under the 6662 regulations, tells us that that level of authority, which again involves the taxpayer penalty, is an objective standard, is less stringent than more likely than not. Now, this will be important, and this is a reg found at Regulation 1.662.4d2. That's important, because you're going to discover when we get to a taxpayer's penalty, substantial authority becomes very, very important. And it's important to note that specifically in the regulations, substantial authority, it does not have to rise to a more likely than not level, which is a greater than 50% chance. So we have a kind of hierarchy here that appears to go, where we go from the highest level of assurance down to the least, shall we say. Kind of think almost like you're in your A&A classes now looking at that, but, one of those fun little things to play with. More likely than not standard, that is, there's a greater than 50% chance of the position prevailing. Substantial authority, there's a less than 50% chance of being sustained, but it's more likely than the reasonable basis standard we're going to find in our 6662. Reasonable basis, it does not meet substantial authority, but is based on some reasonable authority and is not frivolous or patently improper. And then the frivolous and patently improper level of authority or lack thereof. Key issue, for purposes of the substantial understatement penalty on a taxpayer under section 6662D, there is a set of issues for disclosure. That penalty is also one that can be gotten out of if disclosed, just like the preparer penalty. But let's take a look at the rules here of when the disclosure is required. For other than tax shelters, and those are defined in 6662D2CIII, note, that definition happens to be the one that shows up. In essence, that definition was taken essentially verbatim and dropped into Circular 230, paragraph 10.35, or the covered opinion rules. This has presented an interesting problem otherwise that we discuss here about the fact that preparers for years never presumed their taxpayers automatically had tax shelters for that purpose. But last year we started getting, and 2 years ago we started getting disclaimers on everything, because apparently everything suddenly became a tax shelter when people started viewing it under 1035 and it might have been applicable to them. Different concept, but we'll roll forward. But for other than tax shelters, as long as there is substantial authority the item you can get out of the penalty, even if it was not disclosed. However, if it's a disclosed item, it has to meet the reasonable basis category. So again, the taxpayer, in essence, if there's substantial authority, really doesn't have to disclose on the return in that form to get out of this penalty. Now, of course, as we may be aware, that disclosure or lack thereof would generally outline for the examining agent exactly how to attack the transaction or why there are potential issues. Now, that raises the issue, obviously, that if you put that disclosure in the return, you're likely to have the issue raised, even if there is substantial authority. That is, we don't meet the greater than 50% chance. That certainly seems like something the agent should question, and we've given them the roadmap. However, if all we have is a reasonable basis, the taxpayer to get out of this penalty still must disclose, again, if it's not frivolous or patently improper. For tax shelters, if there's a tax shelter as defined under that particular code section, 6662D2CIII, which we've discussed before, is basically the definition we find under paragraph 10.35 that you're going to find in the circular 230 rules, then the position must be one the taxpayer reasonably believed met the more likely than not test when the return was filed. Now, that wording is the key reason why we had the 10.35 covered opinion standards. Because taxpayers could say they reasonably believed it met more likely than not if they had an opinion from a law firm, an accounting firm, that stated that this particular transaction appeared to work, that therefore, based upon that opinion, they had a reasonable belief it met the more likely than not standard. Now, under Section 10.35, that's what we've kind of tried to pull the rug out from under, or what the IRS tried to pull the rug out from under, in marketed tax shelters. Now, these rules and the differential between these rules and what we saw under even old 6694 creates a potential conflict with the client as to what must be told. That is, it was possible you could have a substantial authority position that arguably might not meet the, you know, you could have a substantial authority position that might not meet the 1 out of 3 test reasonable possibility for a preparer test under the old law, where the preparer would need to disclose, but the taxpayer did not. However, most preparers could rationalize that one and believe that if the position was questionable enough that they had to disclose under the reasonable possibility standard, the 1 out of 3, then the taxpayer better disclose too, because it probably didn't have substantial authority to be the way they'd reason it. That comfort zone will be eliminated under this law. Let's remember, substantial authority by definition does not rise to the more likely than not. You can have substantial authority without meeting the more likely than not position, and that is by definition in the regulations. Now let's go to the new law, the one that is applicable now. The new section 6694A says understatement due to unreasonable positions. And this goes on and tells us about the penalty we'll pay and then defines an unreasonable position. And that is, if you knew or should have known of the position, well, that's fine. There was not a reasonable belief the position would more likely than not be sustained on its merits. Pay close attention. That is the highest level of assurance that we have to reach in basically in the penalty provisions in order to avoid the penalty. So, and three, the position was not disclosed as provided in 6662D2BII, or there was no reasonable basis for the position. Okay, that's fine. And there is a reasonable cause exception that still exists. Now, note, a preparer is exposed to the penalty for any position that does not meet the more likely than not test, while taxpayers, by definition, will not be exposed to their penalty if even though a position did not meet the more likely than not test, it still had substantial authority. And let us recall, by definition, positions can have substantial authority and not meet the more likely than not test. Now, what's interesting is the old Section 1034, the Section 1034 Circular 230 effectively dovetailed with the old Section 6694A test, as it prohibited a covered person from signing a return if it didn't meet the realistic possibility standard. And that tells us that position, which is still in the Circular 230 today, provides a practitioner may not sign a return as preparer if the practitioner determines the tax return contains a position that doesn't have a realistic possibility of being sustained on its merits, the realistic possibility standard, unless the position is not frivolous and is adequately disclosed. Now, that's the 1034 standard. Note, that standard has not yet been changed. Where the only place the more likely than not standard appears is the covered opinion rules under Section 1035. Now, while it would not be surprising to see the IRS change Circular 230 to update that requirement, it's not been updated yet. And Congress has not yet changed Section 6662 to bring that provision for taxpayers into compliance with the preparer provision under 6694. As well, Section 6694 now applies to more than just income tax returns. Remember, as we discussed last week, essentially estate, gift, excise tax returns, payroll tax returns now all fall under the 6694 provisions. What that means is if you sign a return that does not meet the more, and has a position that you knew or should have known did not meet the more likely than not position, there needs to be a disclosure there or you are potentially subject to the penalty. Let's remember the penalty. That penalty is $1,000 per return. Basically, if there's a position on this return that did not meet the test, that is a $1,000 penalty. That's the minimum penalty. The penalty can be higher than that, and that is 50% of the fee you received or were scheduled to receive, would have received from the return that you prepared. But note, that means even a widow's and orphan's return, and we all have those types, that is being done as a favor and for which we're getting a minimal or even non-existent fee, shall we say. Well, maybe not non-existent. We're not paid preparer at that point. But let's say we're getting a minimal fee because, you know, good old Mrs. Jones thinks it's just not fair not to be paid at all. So she insists on paying us some nominal sum. And we years ago decided that nominal sum was $50 because that made her happy and it kept us from having to deal with the fact of explaining to her that that's well under what her return really is, should cost her to be prepared if she was really paying our full board. But we take the $50 from Mrs. Jones, makes her happy, and we don't feel too guilty about taking that much from her. We, you know, we prefer to take nothing, but we don't have the choice. That return, that $50 return, could end up costing you $1,000 if it was examined, it was determined that for whatever reason there was a position on the return did not have a realistic possibility of being sustained. Now, let's think about positions that might not have that. What positions might meet substantial authority but not meet, I should say, more likely than not positions that wouldn't have more likely than not but did have substantial authority? Let's talk about positions that might meet that. One example that comes to mind is we have a taxpayer who has records destroyed by a fire. His records are gone, non-existent for the prior year. Well, as we all know, the Cohen case says we can reasonably estimate the amounts on his return. So we come up with a methodology of some sort to reasonably estimate that we're going to argue as a reasonable estimate of his numbers. Here's the hitch you may want to discuss. Is there a greater than 50% chance that that return position, meaning the number you placed on that return for, shall we say, office supplies, will be sustained? Or is it very likely that if it actually got litigated, that the court or the IRS agent, you know, IRS agent's going to take that as kind of a starting point, saying, well, that's what you think it should be. Obviously, that's the most you're going to, you know, that's the amount that you're going to claim that you think's the most you can claim. I'm going to say I want to reduce that, so we want to settle for less. Maybe that doesn't meet the 50% test, but does it meet substantial authority? Well, yes, you would presume. A Cohen test, this is pretty clear. Now the question becomes, Could a preparer be exposed if they don't have substantial and complete and full disclosure of the fact that the Cohen position was being used? And would the taxpayer be in a position where they could get out of any penalty because they could say the Cohen position gave substantial authority even though the issue was not fully disclosed? And the taxpayer may argue that if you list on the return, we are guessing what these numbers are, then have you in fact hurt them by putting that notice on the return? Now, caveat. Those of you who are CPAs know there is a requirement when we're using estimates that we can't indicate a level of accuracy that's not attainable, that when you're using estimates, you're supposed to essentially use round figures, shall we say. So in theory, you're still required to basically disclose a Cohen position indirectly, at least if the agent knows the SSTSs that you have to work under. But we'll ignore that. Theoretically, though, clearly there'd be a number of cases where there could be substantial authority for a position, clearly substantial authority, but it's still not going to make the more likely than not test. And that's our problem for clients. Now, key issue. Well, if that happens and we have disclosure, what in the heck do we have to do to have adequate disclosure? Well, that's a separate rule, and that's covered by a revenue procedure. Now, we've talked about in the past the predecessor to this, Revenue Procedure 2005-75, but this is Revenue Procedure 2006-48 now tells us what is adequate disclosure, both for 6662 purposes and for 6694. And the key issue it discusses when we get down, and this has been reproduced in the materials, the current version of this, we would expect a new version to come out this year since the IRS tends to update this every year. And this new version may very well change the rules since the IRS now may think that Congress is saying crack down on these nasty preparers. Now, basically, what the IRS does, though, the general rule we're going to find in Section 4, that additional disclosure of facts relevant to or positions taken with respect to issues involving any of the items set forth below is unnecessary for the purposes of reducing any underpayment of tax 6662, except as otherwise provided in Section 4.02 that concerns Schedule M1 and M3, provided the forms and attachments are completed in a clear manner in accordance with their instructions. And there's a list we find or O2 of the various items that count for this that would be covered. And they go on for a pretty long period of time about the various odd things you can do. And they cover a number of expenses, a number of items that we really would expect to be on the return or that we'd expect to be matters of issues, including compensation of officers, including trade or business expenses, including various other items here that we would expect to be significant issues on the return. So, you know, hey, that's fine. We've got it there. And as long as we fill it in according with the instructions, we're fine. Now, it does note that the form of disclosure is not adequate if the understatement arises from a transaction between related parties. And if that may present a legal issue contrary because of a related party transaction, then your disclosure must be made on 8275 or 8275R. And also it indicates you have to give adequate description. When an item is shown online does not have pre-printed description, you must classify the item. For instance, if it discloses a bad debt for sole proprietorship, the bad debt must be written or typed on the line of Schedule C that shows the amount of the bad debt. And there are various issues for Schedule M. Now, this provision tells us what we have to do for disclosure. And as noted, we would expect it to be updated for new provisions this year. I would expect this may find that we have a slightly different set of rules. So we'll take a look, and the IRS should update and go from there. Now, these new rules and provisions, what do they mean for your practice? Well, they probably mean you need to consider this issue because there are a number of cases where you have to consider, is there a position on the return? And in the IRS view, a position on the return could effectively, we'll just say, is any number on that return that enters into your tax computation is a position. You took a position to determine that X dollars went on line X. You took a position that X dollars wasn't reportable. That's a position on the return. So any position on the return for which you have information that would lead you to believe that perhaps there is not a greater than 50% chance of being sustained, you now are in a position of, if you fail to disclose it, of potentially having a $1,000 fine imposed on you during exam. You'll need to consider how this might impact how you handle returns or how returns should be handled in your office and how such positions should be flagged and dealt with. Now, we would hope the IRS will be somewhat reasonable in applying this. One key issue to remember in enforcement areas in general is those who are playing cops like to have provisions they're going to use against the bad guys that it's going to be blatantly and obviously clear the bad guys violated them. So, by having a position that is this broad and says it had to be the more likely than not standard, they're no longer going to have to get into arcane technical discussions. They're going to have, the other party now has to show that there was some reason to believe that a judge would go along with this theory rather than just a wild hope that the judge would, but nevertheless, the probability was the judge would go along with this theory. Now, if the IRS uses that standard, that's fine. The concern we obviously have is agents proposing this penalty, and we do know the IRS has been more apt in recent years to want to propose penalties, but an agent proposing this penalty automatically based upon their disallowance of the position. Because in their view, obviously if they're disallowing a position or they're disallowing a deduction or they're increasing income, their view is the position on the return did not have a greater than 50% chance of being sustained because they're not sustaining it. In that viewpoint, it could very well find that practitioners may end up having to deal with this issue more often than they might like. We'll see where we go on those provisions. Now, as noted, we're going to be talking about this provision plus a number of others on July 27th at the Arizona Society of CPAs in their new offices, their new CPE location down on Washington that is opening up Monday. We're going to be down there, as I say, on the 27th of July doing this provision. So if you're available and you want to go ahead and pick up that course, you're in the Phoenix area, feel free to sign up. They're in the middle of sign-up mode now. If you're listening to this podcast now, you missed the early sign-up discount for Arizona Society members. But nevertheless, the course is still open. And if you wish, you can go ahead and sign up for this because I think we'll have some discussions here on the 6694 issue and how we deal with that. As noted, this podcast is sponsored by Limeburg Information Services, located on the web at www.limebergservices.com. And again, that service this week also had a quick discussion of the issues involving this. So you may want to go back if you're subscribed to Limeburg and take a look at their discussion of the issues here on the 6694A changes and how that impacts from their viewpoint this particular change. Again, go to the web www.limeburgservices.com. This has been the Tax Update.